This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, the death toll in Haiti is growing as rescuers reach remote areas while Hurricane Matthew spirals up the southeastern U.S. coastline. Tension between India and Pakistan grows along the line of control that separates the two in the contested region of Kashmir. And in Toronto, a newcomer kitchen gives Syrian refugees a place to adjust and share their culture. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. More than 3 million people are under evacuation orders in three southeastern United States Friday as Hurricane Matthew slowly churns along the east coast of Florida. The storm left a wake of destruction in Haiti, where rescue workers and residents are still digging out and counting the dead. Official estimates are slow to emerge, but media reports put the death toll at more than 500. The hurricane struck Haiti as a Category 4 Tuesday. Many Haitians still live in makeshift structures and tent camps 6 years after a 7.0 earthquake killed 200,000 people. Aerial photographs show entire towns now nearly wiped out by the hurricane, and humanitarian aid groups expect the damage to be broad and the threat of a cholera resurgence high. The waterborne disease killed thousands of people in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake, and public health officials predict another wave of the deadly infection to follow the hurricane. After 5 years of denial, in August, the UN acknowledged involvement in the rampant cholera outbreak, widely believed to have been introduced to the island by UN forces and then spread by inadequate and negligent sanitation at the UN camp. Wednesday, after a briefing at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, President Barack Obama urged everyone still in the storm's path to heed evacuation orders and have emergency plans and supplies in place.
Even as we prepare for the hurricane here at home, I want us to keep in mind that Haiti, one of the poorest countries in the world, already suffering from a range of previous disasters, has been hit really hard by this storm, and we anticipate that they are going to need substantial help.
At least 500,000 people were without power in Florida Friday morning. Emergency officials announced curfews in counties across central and northeast portions of the state as residents in Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina prepare for the onslaught of the storm. Matthew is one of two hurricanes currently active in the Atlantic. Increased severe storm activity has been linked to climate change, as have elevated ocean temperatures. Now, predictions of catastrophic damage to the world's largest coral reef ecosystem have come to fruition. With sea temperatures on the rise, a massive portion of Australia's Great Barrier Reef is losing its pigment in a process known as coral bleaching. But it's not just an issue of color, it's an issue of survival. With 93% of the reef already distressed from a recent global bleaching event, the coral's prospects of recovery look grim, and the world could be seeing the worst of it this month. Georgia Clark has this report.
One of the world's seven natural wonders, the Great Barrier Reef, is in crisis. Sea warming that caused extensive damage to the more than 1,400-mile-long reef earlier this year could now be hindering the coral's ability to reproduce in a process known as spawning. Tourism and Stewardship Director of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Protection Authority, Dr. Roger Beeden, says that the March bleaching was the most significant mass bleaching event seen since 2006.
What we know from previous bleaching events, both in Australia and around the world, is that when corals are stressed, it can reduce their capacity to produce their larvae, and that can have an impact upon the mass spawning event. What could well happen this year is in the areas where there was severe damage, we could actually see a reduction in the quality and the abundance of spawn that's produced.
To get a better picture of the current condition of the Great Barrier Reef, NASA has launched a two-month-long aerial assessment. Mr. Eric Hochberg is the principal investigator of the NASA Coral Mission.
The idea of the mission is to survey reefs in their present state, and relate their condition to the previous environmental conditions. We see what's there right now. We don't see the bleaching event. We see the aftermath. So we'll see a certain amount of coral, and we'll relate that to the temperature conditions of the past and to the wave conditions of the past.
The world's oceans take up more than 90% of the heat created by climate change, resulting in longer periods of higher water temperatures. Corals can handle a certain level of seasonal temperature fluctuation, but not sustained elevated temperatures. According to Dr. Beeden, the recent damage is so great that regrowth could take years, and that's under ideal circumstances. Beeden says regeneration depends on the spawning of healthy corals, which release fertilized eggs that must then travel along currents to reach damaged coral reefs. Although the East Australian Current is moving away from the most devastated area in the north, local spawning events in these areas are still possible, but that full recovery is not guaranteed. Alarm bells about the prospects of widespread damage to the reef began in 1998, after the first mass bleaching event was recorded. With coral mortality now at 22%, and with the coral's reproductive capabilities inhibited, recovery prospects look grim. And Australia's massive reef is not alone. Researchers say with worldwide water temperatures high for a third year running, local conservation efforts are needed on a global scale. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Sydney, Australia.
You're listening to FSRN Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have escalated in recent weeks. The renewed hostility between the South Asian rivals comes amid months of unrest in Indian-administered Kashmir that's just beginning to abate, under harsh repression of both public dissent and the media. The popular Kashmir Reader remains offline and out of print after the government ordered its presses to stop last weekend. Shahnawaz Khan has more from Srinagar.
Widespread public protests against Indian rule have rocked Indian-administered Kashmir for the last 3 months amid government curfews and shutdowns called by the region's separatists. The protests began in early July after government forces killed a young militant commander, Burhan Wani. Since then, police and army forces have killed about 90 people and thousands more have been injured. Hundreds of people have lost either one or both eyes, injured by shotguns used by police, which fire a spray of scattershot at crowds, often leaving a single individual with dozens of metal projectiles embedded in their bodies. Shaukat Lone, a resident of Hajin village in North Kashmir, was struck by pellets while working in his orchard.
A protest march was passing by on the main road. We were sitting in our orchard and police and paramilitary came in through the orchards and attacked the village. They vandalized houses, orchards, and paddy stacks, firing pellets which injured my eyes.
Despite two surgeries, Lone has very little chance of regaining vision in his left eye. His right eye escaped with minor injuries. Doctors at the SMHS hospital in Srinagar have treated about 800 patients like Lone since early July.
We never ever had thought in our dreams that we would receive such huge numbers ever.
Dr. Rashid Maqbool is an ophthalmologist at the hospital.
Around 45 patients are those who received bilateral pellet injuries in both the eyes, what I'm saying. So for them, definitely life has changed completely. Most of them are almost blind. Maybe they can perceive light or maybe hand movements in front of their eyes. That's all they can see.
Dr. Maqbool says the prognosis for most of the other patients with eye injuries is not good. Many are left with vision below 20 by 200, the benchmark for legal blindness in the US. The police launched a massive crackdown in the region to put an end to ongoing protest rallies. Thousands of people have been arrested in midnight raids on their homes, many of them slapped with charges under the controversial Public Safety Act, under which they can be jailed without a trial for 6 months. There are frequent reports of forces vandalizing homes, beating residents, and damaging orchards and paddy stocks in the villages. While the intensity of protests has decreased over the weeks, tensions between India and Pakistan have escalated. Both countries claim the whole of Jammu and Kashmir, and each controls part of it divided by a line of control. India accuses Pakistan of provoking the current unrest in the Indian-controlled region, while Pakistan calls the uprising in Kashmir an indigenous freedom movement.
Peace and normalization between Pakistan and India cannot be achieved without a resolution of the Kashmir dispute.
That's Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif last month at the United Nations General Assembly, where he also repeated the call for a UN fact-finding mission to investigate brutalities by Indian forces in the region.
A new generation of Kashmiris has risen spontaneously against India's illegal occupation, demanding freedom from occupation.
A few days earlier, four suspected militants attacked an Indian army base near the line of control in Udi town, killing 19 soldiers. India accused Pakistan of sending in the attackers and vowed revenge. Pakistan denied the allegation and called it a tactic to deflect attention from the unrest and rights violations in Kashmir. Amid calls for a nuclear war from the media and the public, last week, India's Director General of Military Operations, Lieutenant General Rambir Singh, claimed militants were preparing to enter the country.
The Indian Army conducted surgical strikes last night at these launch pads. The operations were basically focused to ensure that these terrorists do not succeed in their design of infiltration and carrying out destruction and endangering the lives of citizens of our country. During these counter-terrorist operations, significant casualties have been caused to the terrorists and those who are trying to support them.
Pakistan denied any such strikes occurred, but did allege that unprovoked shelling on its posts at the line of control killed two of its soldiers. The hot, turbulent summer in Kashmir has brought the subcontinent to a boil, and without serious diplomatic efforts, many here fear the increasing discord will continue to escalate. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize Friday for his efforts to end the country's 52-year-old armed conflict. The announcement comes just days after Colombian voters narrowly rejected the peace deal between the government and the FARC rebels. In the referendum, a majority of eligible voters abstained from casting a ballot on the peace accord that took 4 years of negotiations to reach. What comes next is anyone's guess, as even the two long-warring parties say neither had a plan B for what all polls predicted would be certain victory in favor of the peace deal. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more from Bogota, Colombia.
The announcement that Colombian voters had rejected the peace accords by a fraction of a percent brought both opponents and supporters to the streets, some in celebration and some in mourning. In Bogota's main square, Plaza Bolívar, people could be seen arguing publicly about the road forward. With tears welling in his eyes, Elias Heruega, an indigenous Makuna man who voted yes, recalled the violence his community has suffered during the Western Hemisphere's longest-running conflict.
They killed my family, my older brother and younger brother. The guerrillas killed 37 people, right in front of my eyes, right in front of my family. Voting for a president who was going to support the violence, we didn't vote twice for Mr. Uribe so that through violence he would solve our problems. He went towards the rural areas and destroyed our communities, our reserves, our riches, and they killed our people, and then became owners of our land. We have to get past this kind of thought. No more war. The war just brings death, desolation, hunger. We deserve something better. New experiences, new lives.
A geographic analysis of the plebiscite results shows that voters from violence-ravaged communities overwhelmingly backed the accords. But Guillermo Villaseñor of the human rights organization Witness for Peace says this defeat at the polls cannot detain the peace process.
This plebiscite narrowly lost, and the people who have been most impacted by this conflict voted very strongly in favor of the accords. And they, many folks in social movements and human rights organizations campaigned for this plebiscite. So I have a lot of faith that despite this setback, that the arc of history bends towards justice.
The night after the referendum, a few hundred university students and ordinary citizens gathered to hold a popular assembly in favor of peace in a park in Bogota.
Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
Para los que no me conocen, mi nombre es José Antequera.
José Antequera's father was a leading member of the Unión Patriótica, a leftist political party that emerged in the 1980s following a peace process similar to the one recently negotiated between the government and the FARC. Hundreds of this party's members, Antequera's father among them, were assassinated in a politically motivated extermination campaign. Many more fled into exile. Antequera says it's essential that people in the urban areas less affected by the war try to understand the situation of rural Colombians.
There's a huge disconnect in our country. The peace process is an opportunity to break this disconnect, and we continue to walk this path so that people in the cities can be aware of the fact that the war affects populations and territories that, perhaps far-flung, are part of our country and that we're all Colombians.
In a way, the referendum results are an illustration of the entrenched polarization that has fueled the armed conflict and associated violence. But many here are not ready to surrender their hopes for peace to a referendum whose margin of victory was a fraction of a percentage point. On Wednesday, tens of thousands of young people marched in Bogota to demand continuity of the peace process. Among them was Jennifer Maria Cortero, whose uncle is one of the 25,000 people disappeared during the armed conflict.
I'd like to tell everyone who doesn't have faith in this process that there's always a first step, and this time victims were taken into consideration in the crafting of these accords. For the first time, victims of forced disappearances were taken into account with a demand to create a special investigation unit to search of our loved ones. Because if we find them, we'll know the truth and there will be justice. But if none of this happens, there will never be neither truth nor justice, and our families will remain always invisible to politicians and parties and groups on the fringes of the law.
In Havana, the chief negotiators for both sides will continue to meet and see if they can hammer out modifications to the accord that a broader majority can agree on. Andalusia Knoll, FSRN, Bogota.
The U.S. State Department announced this week that 84,995 refugees resettled in the country during the 2016 fiscal year. That's just six refugees shy of the year's goal and comes despite efforts by some Republican governors to refuse to accept Syrians in particular. But the U.S. isn't the only house divided over where to host people fleeing the ravages of war. At the height of the migrant crisis in Europe last year, the European Union asked member states to each resettle a specific number of the hundreds of thousands of refugees who were arriving through the Mediterranean Sea. Deeply opposed, the right-wing government in Hungary put the matter to a referendum. Sunday, more than 3 million Hungarians agreed, but the vast majority of the nation's electorate stayed home. FSRN's Andrew Connolly has more from Budapest.
Days before the referendum in Hungary, campaigning reached extremes. On Saturday, at a rock concert organized by Jobbik, Hungary's far-right party, outside of the parliament building, skinheads could be seen giving Nazi salutes. On Sunday morning, at a service at St. Stephen's Basilica, some followers offered prayers to refugees. The vast contrast in attitudes reflects the polarization in Hungarian society based on fears about immigration. Situated halfway between Turkey and Germany, last year more than 400,000 refugees traveled through Hungary, most of them from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan. In response to the crisis, the government constructed barbed wire fences on its southern borders. The country's hardline Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, was quick to label refugees and migrants terrorists and poison. Do you want the European Union to be entitled to prescribe the mandatory settlement of non-Hungarian citizens in Hungary without the consent of Parliament? That's the loaded question Hungarians faced at the polls Sunday, referring to a European Union policy asking member states to take in a specific number of refugees who are currently stranded in the frontline states of Italy and Greece. Some voters, like teacher Terry Feldmar, disagree with the government and the principle of the referendum so vehemently they decided to spoil their ballot.
Because the question itself doesn't make any sense. And on the other hand, I'm against the government and And if I vote yes, it means that there is a I contribute to the chance of the whole referendum being valid.
For liberal-minded Hungarians, the government's hostile stance toward refugees is unacceptable. Nevertheless, more than 3 million voters supported the government's position to reject mandatory quotas, though turnout was only 43%. Many political analysts in the country think that nearly 5%, like Terry, decided to actively spoil their ballots to make sure the 50% threshold required by law for the referendum to be valid was not met, though many mainstream political parties boycotted the plebiscite. At a rally of the Green Liberal Party, Dialogue for Hungary, Speaker Reverend Balázs Zsuzs feared the referendum risks opening up painful episodes of Hungary's World War II past.
I think the Hungarian society is hurted a lot and wounded a lot by this campaign, because we have this this historical memories when the hate and fear killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Hungarian people, and this is a problem.
A peaceful demonstration brutally repressed by an authoritarian regime using tanks and bullets, causing thousands of civilian deaths and prompting hundreds of thousands of refugees to flee across Europe. Such a description fits Syria today, but it was also Hungary 60 years ago during the uprising against Soviet Union-imposed policies. Surely now, it's a double standard that the government agitates so vociferously against refugees. At a so-called victory party Sunday evening, FSRN asked the Prime Minister's chief spokesman, Zoltán Kovács.
In 1956, the Hungarian Revolution produced 200,000 Hungarian refugees and fronted a big global program to resettle them around 37 different countries. I was wondering if you find any irony now in holding a referendum against the refugee resettlement program.
Well, in comparison with the 56 revolution is a lack of knowledge in history, I believe, an ignorance of history, rather. This is a completely different story. At that time, Europe was divided within.
Europe's divided now.
Right, but this is not a division line. What we are doing now, we would like to divide Europe. We would like to unite Europe and defend Europe, actually, in the face of a challenge.
Critics argue that without meeting the 50% voter turnout threshold, the referendum is invalid. But the government says the overwhelming support for more than 3 million Hungarian citizens who did vote hands lawmakers a political mandate. In many ways, the government has already won, as the extremist narrative against refugees grows louder every day, with no resolution to the humanitarian crisis in sight. Andrew Connolly, FSRN, Budapest.
Amnesty International issued a scathing report this week on the state of the global migrant crisis, calling the recent UN summit on refugees a spectacular failure and criticizing most of the world's wealthiest nations for doing the least to address the needs of 21 million refugees worldwide. But the report, titled Tackling the Global Refugee Crisis, From Shirking to Sharing Responsibility, does name two countries that have stepped up to the call, Germany and Canada. In December 2015, Canada announced it would accept 25,000 Syrian refugees fleeing civil war in a nationwide effort with Canadians opening their hearts, homes, and kitchens. Tanya Castle reports.
Asma El-Hariri chops zucchinis in a downtown Toronto kitchen. She is one of a dozen Syrian women preparing tonight's newcomer kitchen meal. The dish? Sheikh El-Mashi Bil Laban, a traditional Levantine recipe consisting of zucchinis stuffed with beef, cooked in a yogurt sauce thickened with eggs, and seasoned with garlic and mint. Restaurant and culinary incubator The Dépanneur hosts the newcomer kitchen. The initiative started out as a space for Syrian women to prepare home-cooked meals for their families while they were stuck in hotels upon arrival in Toronto, and has since grown into a weekly takeout restaurant. Asma has been participating in the project for more than 3 months.
I love cooking, and I love to share and participate in this project because I want to be in touch with Canadian people, with the Syrian people also in my community.
Each Thursday morning, the Syrian women arrive, sometimes with children in tow, at the Dépanneur to cook 50 pre-ordered meals for customers around Toronto. Some know each other from their early days in hotels, and some are meeting for the first time. But they all share similar goals: to make delicious meals, earn some cash, and build a life in Toronto. Asma says knowing English has helped her transition to life in Canada, but that she's still adjusting.
New country, so that's the big challenge for me, to be accustomed to the traditions, to the customs of the Canadian, to the way of life. And the big challenge is to find a job here, yes.
Although the newcomer kitchen was not started as an income-generating project, it does provide pocket money to the women. Each participant leaves with around $75 for a day's work and can also take home leftovers for their families. The Daypanner's owner, Len Senator, says the real value of the newcomer kitchen goes beyond the weekly token payment.
The fact that we can do something that generates a transaction, an equitable transaction, something of mutual benefit, that they can create something of true value, that and the other people can recognize the value and are happy and willing to pay for it, creates for a really dignified exchange. And that, I think, is really the foundation of an amazing type of interaction. It's not charity. It's they've earned this money through hard work, and they're getting something fair for it in return, and the people are getting an amazing meal, and everybody goes away happy.
Additional revenue comes from locals like Don Scarrow, who paid to attend the week's cooking session to learn how to prepare Syrian cuisine.
It's just such a good idea for everybody to participate and then for people in Toronto to get to taste it. Why not? And what an amazing opportunity. The price is right. The food is fantastic. Everybody gets something out of it.
The project got off its feet thanks to Rahaf Al-Akbani and her husband Ishmael Abu Fakhr, a young Syrian couple who came to Canada as refugees earlier this year. Now the couple coordinates more than 50 women in the Greater Toronto Area who regularly participate in the project. Rahaf says it's a lot of work, but worth it to see the women so happy.
They always call me and my husband, when we want to come again, because we had fun and, you know, they got the benefit financially, so they want to support their families. And they always, please, don't forget me. I'm in the waiting list.
Singing classics by famed Lebanese songstress Farouz, it's clear the women are enjoying their work and having fun at the newcomer kitchen. In an attempt to establish a standalone kitchen with salaried positions, Len has launched a fundraiser campaign and applied for charity status. He says the newcomer kitchen model can be successfully applied in other cities resettling refugees. This dream is shared by many of the women involved, including Rahaf.
Maybe there will be a copy over the world, like what Len did. So, because it's a good idea.
With the support of Toronto's mayor and many immigration organizations in the city, it shouldn't be long until more Torontonians are enjoying home-cooked Syrian cuisine. Tanya Castle, FSRN, Toronto.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by BDK Sonic via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.